This podcast mainly serves as a chance for me to catch up and talk shop with various musicians. These are the people I know. I mean, in my line of work, it's hard to venture outside of its tight-knit circles. After a while, having what you do constantly scrutinized publicly can naturally pull you inwards and leave you withdrawn. Over the years, I've noticed that about myself. It's not one person's fault. Most of the people I come across in passing are quite friendly. But after being in this band for about 18 years, I'm always on my guard and ready to defend this band at the drop of a hat. It's an us-against-the-world mentality that I've always assumed. Let's face it, we're not exactly a kumbaya band. We won't be doing covers of Shiny Happy People or Don't Worry, Be Happy anytime soon. So when you have lyrics and music like we have, you gotta be prepared for the polarizing fallout. Now, there is another group of people that I find a kinship with, that I find fascinating to talk to and to talk about. Comedians. As a performer, I find the job of stand-up comedian to be incredibly difficult. The idea that it is assumed you can make people laugh, any given group of people, regardless of societal background, is daunting. At least to me it is. I play music. That's a universal language that cuts through everything. Just ask Iron Maiden, Femi Cootie, Andrea Bocelli, and Beyonce. But for comedy to be truly funny, one must delve into the cultural specifics that other performers have little time to do. Laughter is universal, yes, but it can only be mined under proper context. And it's ironic that when talking to comedians about comedy, things get very serious, and laughter often absent from the conversation. Take Nick Flanagan, who sometimes co-hosts this podcast with me. Nick's a stand-up comedian, and whenever the two of us talk about the comedy scene, off the record of course, it's always done humorlessly. Comedy is a serious business. So recently, when we hopped on the Motorhead motorboat cruise for 4 days with a bunch of bands, I was surprised and happy to find out that comedian Big J Okerson would be on board too, recording his SDR, Sex, Drugs, and Rock and Roll show with Ralph Sutton. Okerson is someone that Nick Flanagan actually put on my radar when he suggested Big J Okerson as a possible guest a year or two ago. At the time, Okerson was passing through Toronto, but for some reason, if my memory serves me correctly, I think we opted not to bother since it seemed like he was too hard to get a hold of. And now, in hindsight, that was a mistake on our part. All I did to get him on this podcast was go up to him on the first day of the cruise and say, "Can I do a podcast with you?" Not hard at all. During the course of the cruise, I was guest on the SDR show, and that set the stage for this episode with Okerson. Like I mentioned, when I get to talk to a comedian about the industry and the ins and the outs, rarely does it get funny. But make no mistake, Big J Okerson is hysterical. Go see him live whenever you can. He's a riot. And go listen to the other podcast he co-hosts called Legion of Skanks. Things get super deep when we both realize we share a fandom for one particular comedian, and that's enough to have us going down a rabbit hole that I never really want to get out of. I want to state here that Flanagan was supposed to be on this episode, but technical difficulties prevented him from doing so, and I know he hasn't been on a few episodes in a while, but I guarantee he is due back, and so look out for Nick Flanagan. Thank you to Blue Mic Microphones for the Yeti mics, and Skullcandy headphones for the Aviator headphones. They work beautifully. Also, like I do for every podcast, I want to thank all the people who have left a message on iTunes or SoundCloud or on Twitter. Thanks, guys. And to the people who come up to me and say they've listened to a certain episode, there's so much out there to listen to, and knowing someone took the time out to listen to this, ramblings of me and my friends, and yada, 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 thanks. I love this episode. It's with Big J Okerson, recorded in the Chinatown Lounge on the Motorhead motorboat cruise. You can actually hear the hum of the boat on this one. And it starts now. The Daniel Jones podcast is the best around. Nick Flanagan is Nick's go out to love for free. I'm so glad I like to sometimes. Damn it, from fucked up. Stop playing. Hang down.
I began to notice that Danko was completely nuts. He'd suddenly start making weird sounds and scary faces for no reason at all. And it wasn't just embarrassing, it was alarming. And now, since I'm a devout Catholic, I asked my local parish priest about Danko's condition, and he was sure Danko was possessed by Satan. So I helped my priest perform an exorcism on Danko that very day, but it didn't work. The dude is seriously screwed, and according to my parish priest, will burn in hell for all of eternity if he doesn't get himself checked out.
It's the one and only, your boy, Danko Jones.
Yeah, so this is the first kind of on-site podcast. I did yours last night.
Yes, indeed, yeah. Chinatown Lounge.
I hope I represented well on your podcast.
Oh, you did great. No, yeah, that was me and Ralph Bosa. That was the most fun podcast we've had. We had like the day before that, we had like 1,000 people come through.
Right.
But yesterday was the hardest we laughed, for sure.
Yeah. I sized up the podcast right away. It's basically you ripping on Ralph. And that's the podcast.
Ralph's got a lot of facts in his head. Spits them out, and then I make fun of his facts.
Yeah. It's an interesting thing, the way that you started your career, if I'm correct, in kind of in the, for lack of a better term, the black comedy.
Yeah.
Circuit or
yeah,
or
black
scene.
Comedy circuit, yeah.
Yeah, which it is a scene unto itself. And then you're here on the Motorboat, which is like the hard rock scene.
The opposite of the black comedy scene.
Was there any kind of like change that you had to do with your comedy?
There was, in the beginning. Well, it was
like making that transition?
It was completely circumstantial doing the black comedy circuit, because where I was at in Philadelphia.
Yeah.
Was at the time, now there is a few mainstream clubs down there, but at the time there was none. In like 1999, 2000.
Oh wow! There was surprised, but
yeah, there was no. Well, there were before that, like in the 80s and stuff. Apparently,
course,
there was like
yeah.
the Comedy Cabana or Coconuts. I think there's one called, and then the club I started at was a Punchline at one point, and then it turned into David Brenner's Laugh House, and then it was just called the Laugh House when I started, and it was a black club at that point. It was like promoted heavily on the hip hop station in town, but. With that said, the benefit of it was for open mic night. Like by the time I went to New York, open mic nights were, you know, 5 people maybe sitting in a room, and then maybe 5 comics also in the room, or 20 comics sometimes sitting.
Yeah.
In the room. But that's not a good audience, you know, and just performing jokes for each other and just trying to get more comfortable. When I came out of Philadelphia, the thing that was beautiful in there was this 300 seat club.
Mm-hmm.
Had like 250 people in it or more every open mic night to watch. So it would just go, and it was like, so the reactions were big. And so I didn't really get to work on the craft of good joke writing in that environment. But very quickly, I just developed. I was like, oh, I learned how to make a black crowd laugh.
Yeah.
And so I pandered a lot.
Right.
But, you know, I wore the clothes that made sense for the situation, everything. I sold my soul a little bit. But I got very comfortable on stage, like not being afraid to do it. And then when I started going to New York to do comedy in the mainstream clubs and trying to crack into that mainstream circuit, yeah, very quickly I just learned. I was like, they don't want to hear the joke you wrote about P. Diddy's new song or like, you know, whatever fucking
So you were
shit.
Tailor-making it that specific.
Yeah,
absolutely. That's pretty specific.
And it wasn't like, but the thing is, I am a music fan, so like, I always listen to everything of always. So the thing was, it wasn't like, I didn't go in there like, I didn't like...
Lie.
I didn't know P. Diddy's song because I was just trying to learn it so a black crowd would like me. Like, I knew the song. And then so, like, it was basically, if it makes sense, like, to this day, I think I do very well if I go to do a black room. I still have like friends and stuff from that scene. They'll ask me to come do shows, and I'll do it in a heartbeat. I have a different approach to it. But in reference-wise, like, I just know a little bit. I think that's what makes a good comedian is you just know a little bit about a lot of things.
Yep.
You know what I mean? If you know a lot about one thing, you kind of pigeonhole yourself. If you're just politics, not that you can't succeed. You get the Bill Maher's of the world, you know. But if you pigeonhole yourself like that, you better find your niche market, because that's all you're going to have. Do you know what I mean?
Yep.
Whereas, like, I think I can come. I've done comedy on, you know, this. Or not this boat, but like Shiprocked and stuff before, which is like 12:30 in the morning, metalheads, drunken, whatever. I can keep them engaged because I know their world too. You know, I know their music. I know their culture. I know, you know, I come from kind of like white trashy roots as well as like, you know, if I was performing for a you know, some kind of a Jewish retreat, like I know people from that. You know, it's like, like if you just have a little bit of an eclectic taste, you can kind of branch it. But all I used in those early years were like, homage to my black hip hop references and stuff like that, just to get over. And then also when you're early in comedy, you're just kind of like, you pander anyway, and you also just want to do well. That's all it is, you know. It's like, it's hard. Like, I didn't want to bomb. I hated it. And then when I came to New York, I said I kind of had to switch gears, because then I would be performing maybe for like 12 people, 5 people at the end of the night, you know. They'd put me on way at the end because I was a new guy, you know, no pay, no nothing. Yeah. So just getting on stage to get on stage.
Yeah.
Or these, like, you know, basements of, like, you know, there'd be chess clubs and there'd be a show in the basement. Thai food restaurants, show in the basement.
Wow.
Bars that just say, we're going to do comedy night in the back. And
how long was this?
How long ago was it?
How long did you slog it out, like, in those venues for?
Oh, man. Well, I did my first
if
2 years.
You can call them venues.
Yeah. My first 2 years basically were just in Philly doing, like, strictly black shows for the most part. So I'd go to New York even. I'd go to these places. Or they're called, like, the Peppermint Lounge and all these, like, notorious places they were considered, because it's like they go to boo you, you know, like they come to be, like, angry and, like, you know, you're bound to eat shit doing it. And they would, like, I did that for, like, just pretty much 2 years straight, and then I met Keith Robinson, who's a great comic, and kind of mentored, he pulled me and Kevin Hart and Kurt Metzger, the three of us started together in Philadelphia. And he pulled the three of us, and we started driving to New York from Philly, like, 6 nights a week. And then, like, just tried that. That's when we started, like, trying to, like, get into those, like, club, the mainstream clubs. But you wouldn't get stage time in those clubs yet, because the pros all worked there. So that's when we have to go, you know, we'd drive up with Keith Robinson. He was a pro. He'd go work those clubs. We'd go to our open mic nights and just these shitty, like, you know, restaurant shows around the city and try to get it together. But, like, yeah, I didn't know. I was trying to just... I was swinging for the fences with everything. But it was good, because I think growth really, like, is promoted by, like, nervous energy and, like, your desire to, like...
Totally.
And also kind of knowing when you're like, oh, what I do won't work here. I have to switch gears. I have to learn how to switch gears and do it. And that's what the mainstream comedy did for me. I was like, oh, I can't go up there, like, in a black room. Like, at the end of the day, if I just start dancing... Put that song back on. Start dancing to it.
Was that part of your act when you were
all that, you know, get up. It was always important. I still laugh to this day when I go do comedy and I go to a club. The club I was just at in Edmonton, Canada.
Oh.
Actually, the Comic Strip.
Okay.
In the West Edmonton Mall.
Yeah, I've been there.
Yeah?
I've been there, yeah.
I go and the guy who runs the music comes in. He goes, what song you want to come out to? I go, that doesn't matter. Like, I'm just going to tell you to turn it off the second I get up there. It's like, what do I, you know, I'm not going to dance first. I have no routine. But I laugh because there, sure as shit, there was a time, though, where it mattered. You got the new Beat Nuts song?
Cause right.
You know, because I'm going to wait until they say a certain line and be like, what's this dude talking about? You hear, that doesn't even make any sense. You know, just
right.
Try to do a joke about that.
Right.
And connect in the moment, which is like, I'm just kind of beyond that now. And if it makes sense also with the new mediums of, like, be a podcast or stuff like that, like if I have, like, a funny joke about a goofy song I heard, like, you just make that on that, you know, it's not really a stage necessarily.
Do you, like, find doing your Legion of Skanks podcast, do you find the same way? I talk to comedian friends and they're like, well, I'm not gonna do that joke on Twitter because I'm not gonna say that on Twitter because that's a zinger that I could use on stage. So doing the podcast, do you find, like, do you come up with stuff, or do you, like, kind of edit stuff out because you want to save it for the live show? Like, obviously the live is more important than the podcast, or like, do you know, you ever find yourself going, I can't use that, I'm gonna save it for
I never overthink it, man. I just keep talking. And in fact, the way I approach comedy now, what happened for me very much was like my trajectory as far as, like, how I even came up with material was, first I would sit down and I would try to write things out, like write out jokes.
Yeah.
And then I got, this is from advice from, like, Keith Robinson and the guys who I kind of looked up to, was just like to continue, like just write and get this. The 15 minutes is pretty much what a comedy set is in like the city, in New York City. Just get the 15 minutes that just kills. And so it, everyone just trusts that you kill. You know, when you go on stage, that you hit it home run every time and get good with it. So I started doing that. But, you know, if you're a funny, if you're a naturally funny person, if you're a guy who's in business and you, there's a lot of comedians who are not very funny people, but they learned how to like turn a joke, you know, turn a phrase and
make
it happen.
It's almost like the schooled way, like you take a class or something.
Almost, yeah. Or some guys just know, they're just witty, you know what I mean? They're kind of like dry guys, but they write funny. Those guys end up becoming writers, most of them, you know?
Right, right.
And for like TV shows and stuff. But that was never really my skill. So when I wrote stuff, I found that I tended to write very like, I'd write something and then I'd go to a club and then someone would be like, ah, so-and-so's kind of got something like that. And I go, yeah, so I would stop. And that kind of put me into a really a concerning thing where I was like, well, how do I find my own kind of voice and style in this? Because then it became everyone that I opened up for. The next week I was like, you know, adapting their
really
thing. Not like not stealing material.
No.
It's like, but just like I'd see.
It's kind of like with bands when you tour with a band.
Sure. To this day, I feel like I'm very much a hybrid of like my, the guys who mentored me the most, who really like took me under their wing and taught me about comedy and how to do it, was Patrice O'Neill, the late Patrice O'Neill, and Dave Attell, who still to this day is like a guy, you know, who call me, what are you doing? What do you? What's your next step? You know, what do you need help with?
That's amazing that you have his ear like that.
Yeah. Oh yeah.
I mean, he's a genius.
Genius. Absolutely. Yeah. I agree. Yeah. And yeah, I'm so like tightly woven into him, man. But it's you know, he's a guy who. But those guys came at a different time, so I'd watch Patrice. But I remember I said to go back where I said I'd open for people and pick up their thing. Like I'd open for Dane Cook at Caroline's in New York for a weekend, and then you know the next 2 weeks, like all my jokes, like I'm doing a lot of pointing and like you know very posturing on stage, all the kind of the shit he does.
Yeah.
And then whoever it would be, you know, I'd watch Brian Regan and I'd kind of have some of his like mannerisms after that, or Attell, or Patrice. But to this day, I mean, I sit on a stool on stage. And I really make the crowd, I force them with my energy to come to me.
It's kind of like Rollins standing come, in one spot.
Yeah, yeah. I make them all come to me, and they will. And eventually they kind of wonder, it's a pissing contest. It's a chest out, kind of like it's an alpha male thing where you put your, but it's a calmness to it. It's very zen because you're waiting. Like if you don't get nervous and you wait for them, eventually people are going to want to know, it's like, well, this guy really is like, all right, he seems to.
Yeah.
Be pretty cool and collected. Because
yeah.
Comics break all the time, you know, they get nervous.
Yeah.
But to
I can't even watch when that happens.
Oh, I love it.
I know you love it. It's hard to watch. I like watching bands break.
When they have like a meltdown.
Yeah.
Yeah, of course, as I said, it's your own, whenever you're in your own field, you're like, because you know it's like it's almost like watching a football game, you know, when you're like, when you're watching your team lose, like, why would you have thrown the ball there? You know, it's the same thing. So I watch a guy who's just eating shit on an internet clip, and you're just like, how is he just letting this happen? Be my favorite one, and I've talked about it at length, and I feel bad. I never give the guy's name, but there's just an episode of the worst comedy show of all time called Who Got Jokes? You ever heard of that show?
No.
Bill Bellamy hosts it. It's on TV1 in America.
Right.
It's called, and it's like a, which is a black network, I think, pretty much. But it's just a show where they bring out four comics from the black circuit, pretty much, almost exclusively. And then they have an audience, which is pretty much black audience. And then they just get four random audience members. This is the worst thing to do to comics. Could you imagine them doing this to bands? Four random audience members, or three. And they just have them judge this contest, basically. And it's two rounds. The first round, all the comics come out. And they they do a comedy set, like a short comedy routine. It's always pretty shitty. It's always pretty much the same topics. It's very like, you know, hacky black circuit comedy. And these guys, these idiots in the audience, judge them poorly. They always give like fantastic scores for the most part.
Yeah.
And it just goes weird. And then the round two is they always add in some, they call it the comedy skills round, where they just add in some kind of, I've seen them do everything from they throw a pie in your face in the middle of your set, like they have somebody come behind you and be like, excuse me, and you turn around like you're doing comedy on TV, and you turn around confused and they hit you in the face with a pie, and you expect it to continue on and go with your
right.
jokes
like, like a obstacle course or something.
Yeah, yeah. Or then sometimes they have like a planned heckler in the audience to yell out stuff, and it's just funny to watch.
Jeez.
So people melt all the time, but they always give them good scores for some reason, no matter what. But there was just one episode of this guy, and it was the only time I've ever seen. They did it in Vegas, and they had a celebrity judging panel, which consisted of Ray J. Celebrity in quotes, I guess. Ray J and a girl.
E-list?
Yeah. A girl from the Steve Harvey show, and like some other, I can't remember the other girl, was from another show, maybe Cedric the Entertainer show or something. But it was just a ridiculous panel. And this guy just comes out and he just bombs twice. And I, however many hits that thing had on YouTube, like 4,000 had to be me. Because whenever I'm feeling down, I can just watch that, because I watch that like I'm screaming at the Super Bowl and my son's playing and losing. So I'm just like, how can you let Ray J shit on you? Because he was aggressively mean, Ray J, to this comic. And the guy just sits there with like a sour face, like, oh, jeepers. And it's like, it's Ray. The guy's famous for one thing, man. Like, he banged someone on video and he's Brandy's brother. Like, you can't find shit to make fun of this guy for. I mean, how easy would that be?
Yeah.
Sure, he's got a huge dick. You gotta bow to that first, see past it, as hard as that may sound, and move forward. But yeah, I do love, but you have a hard time watching comics, but I guess the same thing. I would have more of a hard time watching
I'll sit there and I'll just go, oh, Jesus Christ.
They said the people here, people here the other day were having
you were talking about that.
The girl who was just sitting in here with us was telling us, she was like, it just went, kept looking at his watch and everything, and it going bad. Like, but I think that's a real mark. And I kind of learned that from Patrice, was anyone can kill on stage for a long time. You know what I mean? If you're killing, if the crowd's just hot and they're in every word you're saying, even if what you're saying normally doesn't do that well, just, you know, sometimes you just have a crowd that's just jacked up and they're ready to laugh. The shittiest comic could murder for an hour and a half, 2 hours. The real test is like, how long can you sit up there confidently and not freak out when it's going shitty? That's much more of a tell of someone's character of a good comic. Do you know what I mean? Like, if it's not going good.
It's the same when, like, equipment dies and you got nothing to do. You got to talk to the audience. And it's taken me years to adapt that kind of real calmness.
Yeah.
And not start freaking out. I've seen bands when they freak out and they're just yelling at the roadies, or they just fucking storm off stage, and I like that.
Then
I started talking to the audience. And
that's what I used to see you having with Marilyn Manson. That was a very classic Marilyn Manson thing. I saw him so many times in concert. And like, yeah, you see like abusive to the roadies when something goes bad, and no crowd interaction. You know what I mean? He has no like.
I mean, maybe it works for him in his image, but my whole thing is to talk to the audience. I see too many bands who don't really properly address an audience and make them know that, hey, look, like, we really want to be here.
Yeah.
And I really want to fucking rock out in front of you.
There's a few I've felt that. I mean, I think Rob Zombie does that. I think Rob Zombie he really talks to the crowd and makes like a fun thing with them in the back and forth, you know. It's cool. Watching Phil from Down.
Phil's amazing at that.
But it's funny, I only got a chance to see Pantera one time on the Reinventing the Steel tour, and I think he was like in bad shape then, and like he didn't really connect with the audience very much. Awesome show, live show, but like I've never seen that rapport with the audience really, so it was such a cool thing to get to watch that.
And he is a very funny guy, naturally funny man.
Yeah, so, that's what I'm saying.
It's like, a lot of people don't realize until
he's always scowling. It's an image, you know, but like, which is cool. It makes for the music, you know. It's like, and there's also a thing about being intense about something doesn't make you like, you know, always across the board that kind of person. You know what I mean? Like, you could be intense on stage and yet still be like an okay guy, I guess, you know. That's why that's my fear of meeting Marilyn Manson, which I think I told you is like, if he's a douche, it's gonna just bum me out. And I have a feeling he probably is.
there's something I know about you, and I think I can call him one of your heroes because he's one of mine. Is Dice?
Oh yeah, absolutely.
Have you met Dice?
I have met Dice. You hear my girlfriend laughing over there because I got stoned one night. And just like, it was not too long ago. And I wrote him like I call it a love letter. It wasn't a love letter, but I just wrote some Facebook message that was very just like, I don't even know what I was thinking. I've been doing comedy way too long to do this. Like, This is a year ago, maybe. So I'm in comedy 14 years, maybe 15 years of comedy. And I've met and worked with the greats
Dave
and
Attell.
Friends. Yeah, Treason, Dave Attell, yeah, friends. Right. Yeah, all these guys, like people right. I just know. And Dice just and me just never really crossed paths. But a million people who we know together who have, you know?
I have.
You know, who've crossed paths.
Even
with
I
him?
Have. Even I have. Some dude in well, a rock band.
We've passed each other, you know, we've gone by, but we've never, no one's ever been like Dice, Jay, yeah. And then we've had a conversation. It's never happened. So, yeah, I wrote this letter to him. It was just the worst. Like, the worst thing a dude can do
is
to
it
a
like
dude.
What I think it is?
It was just like,
you're so cool, man.
Basically. I was like, and then also, even worse, like giving a comprehensive list of people he can check it just to see my legitimacy. I'm like, you can talk to Norton and Artie Lang and these guys and Dave Attell, all friends of mine that you could, you know, vouch for me. He goes, we should do something together, man. We should. It's just like asking a guy to jam through Facebook.
Yeah.
And I'm like, we should. I don't even know what I expect
you
him
had
to say
have been
or
high.
Do. You know,
you were
yeah.
out of your mind when you wrote this, right?
Not out of my mind. Just stoned. Just simply stoned and feeling emotional. And I sent it. And it was when I told people, I was like, oh, mistake, man. As soon as I sent it, I was like, that's weird. And then, sure enough, the only lucky thing about that story is that he didn't write back. It was a thing the next day. And she wouldn't even wrote back, but she felt bad. It was like, hey, this is like Jessica Dice's assistant. Like, I'm doing all of his web stuff for him. He doesn't really answer his own stuff. She felt so bad about this heart pouring. Like, I'm like,
well,
just,
that was
ma'am.
Nice, though.
Because it was nice. Yeah. But I really gave it like a, you know, because like, he is Dice. And I say this. I don't know why I always got a disclaimer this because it sounds like I'm taking a shit on him. But I mean, I bet you have this with music. I bet some of your music, like idols growing up, I bet when you see them perform now, you see, if nothing else, like the holes in their game.
Okay,
they're a little yeah. soft on that. Even though I love them still. And same thing with Dice. Like, I love Dice. I'm a sucker for his. I got the new, I DVR'd the new special on Showtime, yeah. and I go watch it. And I watch it critically. Do you know what I mean? But at the same time, when I watched him do comedy when I was a kid, I was like, man, that just looks. I didn't watch Eddie Murphy and be like, I want to do that. I watched it with a very like, that makes me laugh. I think he's funny. Richard Pryor. When I watched Dice, I was like, oh man, like I got a dirty mind. You know, I'm a little kid. I was 12, 13 years old. I was like, and he's just saying everything I want to hear. Talking about tits to start off. I was like, so I got my tongue up this chick's ass. And I'm like, this is great.
Yeah.
I can't believe they're saying these things. So I loved it. Yeah, I just thought
a lot of people don't like give Dice the credit. And they just, even within the comedy community, I'm always trying to like vouch for him that like, if you go deep on Dice, forget about the nursery rhymes and the, you know, all that, like, whatever, Jack and Jill stuff.
Sure.
That's for, like, the people who kind of, when you go deep on, like, Day the Laughter Died, Part 1 and 2,
yeah.
and Filth, like, deep in those tracks, there is shit that is on par with Kinison and Carlin and Pryor, that all these people who, like, talk highly about comics and which one, like, Bob Newhart and Rickles. Fucking Dice is on par, man. Some of that fucking shit he says.
The thing,
and it's not even dirty.
No,
like, even the non-dirty
Day
stuff.
The Laughter Died, his commitment to that, he just gets lost in that phrase.
Our back,
hour
get
back,
it?
Hour back, get it?
That's the best comedy
the best
bit
part of it,
in
yeah.
the world. Ever.
It doesn't mean anything.
You're laughing. You don't even know what I'm talking about. Or whatever.
Yeah, there's conditioned because he's saying it with such like a gusto. You know, I love that. It was like, catch an hour back, get it. And the crowd's just like confused. Like, but they're laughing. That made me laugh so hard.
I laughed so hard.
An hour back.
And that's when I realized like this guy's a genius.
Yeah, the weirdness.
And that
the,
has nothing to do with like, oh, I got some tits and all this.
And the thing about Dice with the problem is he's an idea that kind of swallowed itself a little bit. It's almost like Girls Gone Wild did the same thing. It's like an idea that swallows itself where it becomes to me, he never got the corny level that like a Larry the Cable Guy got, but it's Dice, unfortunately, is the same category, but I don't think people really realize that even. Like, Dice is a character. Not that people don't know he's a character, but he was a character of a stand-up routine. Like, Andrew Clay did Dice. Andrew Clay did Jerry Lewis. He was an impressionist. He really is like a quintessential 80s comedian. Because all those guys, you know, Dice's instincts are to sing a song, dance. I mean, all of his specials have incorporated some kind of acting where he plays the nerds in the beginning and does that whole thing, the story of Dice. It's essentially Larry the Cable Guy, but it's just like it was much more of a cooler character that people were able to latch on to. I thought the movie was hilarious. Like I took the whole ride with him. Like I thought he was fantastic. To me, he can do no wrong. But like, it's to get to me, I'd love to be like a tighter with him. You know what I mean? But like, I think he's great. And I said, going back to like, my first thing with him was his first thing was at Dangerfield's special. The Young Comedian special. His hair was a little bit longer. But I mean, that guy by trade wanted to be an actor. He had no interest in being a professional stand-up comedian. But he said, I heard in that Stern interview. Did you ever hear that thing he said? He was telling it was his most recent one.
Oh,
where he said,
if it's recent, like 2 years, no.
Yeah, I think it wasn't about the past 2 years. But he did a thing where he said he did that Dangerfield special. I think it was like 2 years later he was selling out the Madison Square Garden.
Oh, that I heard. Yeah, I've heard all that.
Overnight.
Yeah.
How crazy is that, man?
It's crazy.
What an amazing... I mean, that does happen in music too, obviously. Yeah. In pop music. But Dice wasn't pop music, man. Dice really was like an indie band.
He's like a black metal band. Yeah. Like he's a black... Yeah, it's like...
I mean, it was such a cool thing to see that happen.
Something X-rated. Yeah, totally.
Yeah, I loved it. Like I said, you know, and it's a shame, like... but the hole you dig for yourself, and it's to use Phil Anselmo as an example again, like if tomorrow it was like, well, yeah, like that's my stage, my metal character, you know what I mean? Like, no, I'm doing a show on Home and Garden TV about botany, you know what I mean? I like planting flowers, I'm all about, people be like, what the fuck? And Dice made that mistake, if you remember. I'm not sure how old you are, but when he went on Arsenio Hall.
Yeah, I remember
Adventures
that.
Of Ford Fairlane came out.
Yeah.
It was out of the theater in 2 weeks because the protests were so big, which at the end of the day really is like very good publicity because people protested so much that it was out of, they removed it from theaters. And he went on Arsenio Hall, and rather than being like, you know, fuck you, America, you dumb cunts, he cried. He got bummed out. He got teary.
I didn't see that.
You can watch it on YouTube. He goes, and then he did his Dice thing right away. He got teary eyed. He just tries to give a speech. He goes, I'm just trying to make people laugh. You know what I mean? Like, and he said it with no aggression. It was a complete, like, soul bearing. You know, he just tried, and in the middle, he got choked up in the middle of his words. And then does, like, you know, he flicked his jacket collar up and took a puff of the cigarette.
And
came back in. But I mean, you can almost pinpoint that moment as the end of his like, Madison Square Garden selling out thing. Like,
but he was going without a compass. He's the only one out there that far out into the ocean.
Was trailblazing in that regard. There was always that thing where it was like him and Kinison. I'm like, Kinison's a different kind of comic.
You know, he is
not in
different.
A bad way. Just avoided Kinison was.
People put them on the same category, and they're not.
Oh man, Dice
equally amazing.
Yeah, absolutely. No argument there. But Dice was just like, man. Kinison had to jump almost like genres to get his like the howlers. Do you know what I mean? The howling mad people by doing like, you know, he linked up with the rock stars and the wild thing and stuff. Like Dice,
Black and White.
Just drilled it himself, man. He was like, you know what? I'm gonna go out there and I'm gonna say cunt 50 times on an HBO special. And people are gonna fucking love it. And to go back to the very beginning of that is why I have such an affection for him. Is I just remember when I was 10 years old, my mom started dating my stepfather, and my mom was young. I have a young mom, so it was like a 29 year old dude in the house, and I'm 10, and it was just like, you know, I don't know how I felt about it. You know, I was a little weird. It was changing things the way I knew them, and I was definitely kind of like rebelling about it. But like my step-pop, his friend let him borrow the VHS of Dice Man Cometh, the first one he did with the big fuzzy dice behind him, and he comes out to Whipping Post, the Allman Brothers.
Okay.
And he walks out, and we just watched that special. I got goosebumps just saying that. And we watched that special, and that was like why it meant so much to me, why I wrote that stupid letter to him, was because when I went to school the next day, as far as the best as my memory will tell me, like, that's when people started thinking I was funny. Because that's where I was like, oh, like, I'm going to be funny like that. Like, I'll just be the over-the-top.
You put that in the Facebook
dirty. And, yeah, no. I didn't say no. No, I'm just saying, like, in the Facebook. The reason I was, like, right, I wrote that, like, right, goofy letter to him, like, you know, we should really work together. I'm a big fan. You're the reason I do comedy. And yeah. No, but I didn't say anything about my stepfather. But that really is what it is. Like, it's the thing, like, me and him, I thought it was so cool that he let me listen to that. And watch. I think he even gave me, like, a don't let your mom know I let you watch this. Because right.
it's a bonding thing.
Yeah, and it was just cool. And then, I got the cassette of Dice Rules was the next thing he did. Before I watched the actual video, I got the cassettes. I remember when it came out. I remember the cover of the album was the jacket, sparkly leather jacket with Dice written in the sparkles, the red sparkles.
I have it.
Yeah?
The VHS.
Yeah. It's so good. But I had the audio cassette. Like, it was a double cassette, Dice Rules.
Right.
And
I have it now on CD.
Yeah. And I put it on my boom box, you know, and I was like, and to be how young I was, I mean, I was like, I would take a bath still sometimes, you know what I mean? Like, listen to Dice.
Right.
And, like, play with toys, maybe, you know, G.I. Joe's or something, and listen to Dice. And I just, like, it was so, I loved him. I thought, yeah.
Well, when I saw him, he came to Toronto to play Massey Hall. The opener was Don Jameson.
Oh, nice.
And Don's friends were friends.
Sure, yeah, so Don from Metal Show.
Yeah. So come on out, you know, you can meet Dice and, you know, we can whatever, hang. I'm like, whatever. Maybe it's just going to be like 5-10 minutes. I put Day the Laughter Died on vinyl in my bag. And then, you know, things happen, whatever. Maybe did an hour. That's not short.
That's good.
I'm like, I could sit there for 3 hours.
Sure, but that's headline. That's headline.
Yeah, it just went by so fast. And then we're back in the dressing room and it's just me, Don, and his son.
Max
and Dice, the four of us. And Max is kind of his helping him out, so he's coming in and out. And Dice launches into more material that he never did, and it's just. And then after that, we went back to the hotel, me and Don, and he goes, "Oh, you didn't get your record signed." And I said, "That 15 minutes with Dice doing material,
more worth it, yeah,
worth." And he was doing shit that just happened to him, like personal stuff with his girlfriend. He was complaining to us,
yeah.
And it was a real. It was like, I think it was real, but it seemed like a bit, you know.
And he, and
but it was real.
Well, that's what's interesting about him to me is like, and I just talked about Joe Rogan about this too, is that he did make a choice at some point, which I think probably happens in music too, because. Especially when, like, major success hits. Like, I bet Axl Rose is a different human being now than he was when, like, you know. I bet when they go, we're going to, you know, we just wrote Welcome to the Jungle. It's like, well, we're going to play on the radio. They're like, wow, neat. To being, like, you know, this guy, it's like, I don't talk to people. You know what I mean? Like, stay away.
I'm sure he's had the ultimate punishers over the years come up to him.
So. Oh, yeah. And also just to kind of be like, but just the thing where it's like a guy who's like lives a certain kind of way, like, you know, is your personality takes on something.
Yeah.
And I think what's funny about Dice is like, you know, especially the idea of swallow itself, like Dice has become Dice. Andrew Silverstein's become Andrew Dice Clay. I mean, I've seen, when I do see him, he was at the Comedy Cellar a couple months ago, I guess it was now, and my girl was even like, well, just go introduce yourself. I'm like, it's just weird to me to do. I go, I want some, and Florentine was right there, and I was like, maybe Florentine will call me up. I think Florentine just assumes I know him, because it's so odd that him and Rogan were the two guys that I never like really crossed paths with, so I just did Rogan's podcast, and that's kind of out of the way now, but Dice and me just never really like had a thing where we connected at all, but watching him outside the cell, where he's got the gray mutton chops, he wears those big, crazy, like, you know, Terminator glasses, sweatpants, shorts, the Joey Buttafuoco cut tank, you know, the sweatshirt. And it's like the leather knuckle gloves and the whole thing. It's so...
It's updated, but it's still him.
Yeah, but it's so... But it's just so funny that it's like, that's how he just goes around. Like, he just lives life as Dice now. That's like all day long. But did you ever see Ford Fairlane?
Yeah.
I love that movie.
I have it on DVD.
I think it's great. Yeah. I think his impressions when he's falling, my hair.
I've tried to like steer people, try to convert them.
Yeah.
I don't know if it works, but play them specific bits.
And some people just won't get on board.
They can't get on board. But it was fun to chat with you guys and fun to do the podcast last night. Ralph's here as well, so thanks.
You're
a
wearing
lot,
a Ralph Sutton shirt. Frankenstein. Christine said we just got to put bolts in your neck on Thanksgiving. Let's just do it on Thanksgiving. Will you be Frankenstein for Thanksgiving? I was going to say Halloween.
I started off going, I get the dynamic of the podcast, and here it is, right on ours.
I bust Ralph's balls, and then Ralph, he's like my dad.
Well, thanks, Jay. Thanks for
coming. Thank you for having me, man.
We wanted to get you, like I told you when I met you a few days ago.
Yeah.
We wanted to get you when you came through Toronto. My co-host, Nick Flanagan, who's a comedian.
Yeah.
I think you guys have done the same
I'm
nights.
Sure, yeah.
So he's like, we should get this guy. So that's when I checked you out, and that was like a year ago and stuff.
Nice.
Yeah, let's get him. And then I'm like, oh, fuck.
You live in Toronto, right?
Yeah.
No. I go to Toronto. I do comedy bar a lot.
Oh, yeah,
in Toronto.
Yeah.
I don't do the improv nights. I do the stand-up nights there.
Nick tells me who to see. Like, I'm like kind of like the guy, your friend that you go, you got to come see this band, Metallica. Awesome. I'm the guy who gets brought.
Do you? Let me give a plug to this place you should check out while you're in Toronto. Have you ever gone to the Underground Comedy Club, Clandestiny?
Yeah, I have. With the pop.
That
one.
Is my favorite place.
Yeah, I've been there to see Nick play.
It's the only place where you perform, and when you perform, a guy just passes out, and there's a hippie girl rubbing his head going, shh. Just like they go, just a green out. Everyone's I love that room.
You can't bomb because
you
everyone
can't bomb. Yeah, it's so. Above. Everyone just giggles and has a great time. Toronto is one of my favorite cities to perform in, absolutely. So I will see you there.
Thanks, Jay, and I'll be there. Thank absolutely. You very much.
Nobody.